From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we meet George Clinton, the master of funk. He's combined soul and acid rock, pioneered rap, and created one of the most outrageous stage shows in music. We also meet one of the world's greatest classical violinists, Shlomo Mintz. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles how producers Leon Huff and Kenny Gamble captured the Philly sound. And book critic John Leonard reviews Thunder at Twilight, Frederick Morton's look at Vienna on the eve of World War I. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. Voters across the country are casting ballots for mayors, governors, and local officials in today's off-year election. Hundreds of mayoral contests are at stake, including big city battles in New York, Cleveland, Detroit, Houston, and Seattle. The polls have closed in Virginia, where Democrat Douglas Wilder is trying to become the nation's first elected black governor. In New York City, where Democrat David Dinkins is trying to become the first black mayor of America's largest city. Turnout has been heavy today in New Jersey. There, voters are choosing a new governor. The race pits two congressmen against each other, Democrat Jim Florio and Jim Corter, a Republican. Jim Zaroli reports.
Florio went into today's election a heavy favorite to win, and exit polling indicates the odds remain in his favor. Democrats outnumber Republicans in New Jersey, and Florio has reportedly done well among independents, the state's largest voting bloc. The polls also say most voters identify themselves as pro-choice. That is bad news for Corter, who has a strong anti-abortion voting record. But the polls say the number one issue in the state today has been reform of New Jersey's troubled auto insurance system. For National Public Radio, I'm Jim Zaroli.
Election officials in the Seattle area are predicting a 50% voter turnout today. Carol Levinson reports there are a couple of hotly contested issues on the ballot.
Even with overcast skies, election officials in King County say voter turnout is heavy in some parts of the Seattle area. The main issues drawing Seattle residents to the polls are a mayoral race and two ballot initiatives. If City Attorney Doug Jewett wins the nonpartisan mayor's contest, he will be the first Republican mayor the city's seen in two decades. If City Councilmember Norm Rice wins, he'll be Seattle's first black mayor. Closely tied to the mayor's campaign is a ballot measure to get rid of the Seattle School District's mandatory busing program. A statewide initiative asks to raise the sales tax for children's programs and services. Many observers say all three ballot items are too close to call. For National Public Radio, I'm Carol Levinson in Seattle.
East Germany's cabinet resigned today. The cabinet, led by 75-year-old Premier Willy Stoff, has little power and puts into effect policy made by the Communist Party's ruling Politburo. Several communist officials and three small parties allied with the communists have urged the Politburo itself to resign. New party leader Egon Krenz said five Politburo members closely associated with former leader Erich Honecker will be replaced by the end of the week. Voters in Namibia waited in 95-degree heat for hours today to cast ballots in an election that will open the way to independence after 74 years of South African rule. Some lines were more than a mile long. No serious political violence was reported on the first of 5 days of the UN-supervised elections. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average rose almost 15 points. This is NPR News. Today, the former head of the Federal Home Loan Bank Board testified before a congressional panel that four senators had asked him in April of 1987 to go easy on a troubled thrift institution. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
Edwin Gray told the House Banking Committee today that Senators Dennis DeConcini, Alan Cranston, John Glenn, and John McCain asked him to drop a regulation that limited the amount of risky direct investments thrifts could make. The senators were intervening on behalf of Lincoln Savings and Loan, a high-flying thrift with lots of risky investments in real estate, hotels, and junk bonds. Lincoln was owned by Charles Keating, an Arizona businessman who had made large contributions to all four senators' campaign funds. All four senators have taken issue with Gray's account of the meeting. The actions of the four and a fifth senator, Don Riegel of Michigan, who intervened in another meeting on the matter with bank examiners, are currently the subject of a review by the Senate Ethics Committee. At the Capitol, I'm Mara Liasson.
A Senate subcommittee voted 7-6 today to impose strict new controls on auto exhaust pollution, but opponents and supporters agree the issue has not been resolved. The provision, similar in its initial stages to one approved by a House subcommittee, was passed over the objections of the auto industry and the Bush administration, who contend consumers will pay an extra $500 a car as a result. According to congressional testimony today, the Environmental Protection Agency may be improperly excluding up to 2,000 hazardous waste sites from its Superfund cleanup program and deliberately limiting the number of cases it will handle. Witnesses at the House subcommittee hearing say the EPA system for identifying sites that would qualify for Superfund and federal aid for 90% of the cleanup cost is inadequate because it relies heavily on state and local governments. Witnesses say the states are sometimes reluctant to report sites because they have to pay 10% of the bill. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington.
This is Fresh Air, and I'm Terry Gross. If funk began with James Brown, it was my guest George Clinton who was responsible for many of the innovations in the funk music of the 70s and 80s. He brought electronics into his rhythm tracks and used a guitar sound inspired by acid rock. His songs had repetitive group vocals with witty lyrics that rock critic Ken Tucker called aggressively vulgar and brilliantly literate. Clinton created a funk empire, which included the bands Parliament, Funkadelic, P-Funk, and the Brides of Funkenstein. Parliament and Funkadelic had the same musicians, but Clinton presented his more polished material through Parliament. Funkadelic was wild and improvisational and put on extravagant stage shows that incorporated science fiction plots and elaborate mythologies. The musicians wore outlandish costumes and hairdos. In his alter ego of Dr. Funkenstein, Clinton sometimes made his stage entrance from a flying saucer. Since 1982, Clinton has also recorded under his own name. He had a hit in 1983 with Atomic Dog. He's just released his first new album in over 5 years. This is the title track, The Cinderella Theory. That's Cinderella Theory, the title track from George Clinton's new album. George Clinton, welcome to Fresh Air.
Yeah, I just got defleed and got the ticks off of me. I got my doggy bag, and I'm going to go get my rabies shots, and I'll be ready for them. How you doing, baby?
Okay. What got you back in the studios and on the road after 5 years?
Oh, I got tired of laying up being an old dog and not learning new tricks. So I said, let me get back out there, because, you know, when rap started getting heavy like it is now, I said, that's an old trick right there. I said, I can do that. So here I am, back out here talking stuff.
How do you feel when a rapper uses one of your rhythm tracks on one of their
records? It. Uh-huh. Well, you know, the ones that use too long, they pay.
And right.
The rest of them keep us alive. I mean, like, who's it? Me, Myself, and I.
Right, yeah.
That particular one, I'm glad they did that one because, I mean, it brought my whole thing back to life. Plus, they paid good.
Mm-hmm.
De La Soul, the company paid real good. But the main thing is that it brings you back to life if you know how to use it. Like, they did it with James Brown, too. And what I did and I learned from him was that I didn't get upset. I figured out a way to benefit from it. So I sampled my record back off of this and some of this.
Well, I'd be curious in hearing about what music you first heard that made you want to make music yourself.
Oh, wow. I can almost tell you precisely what it was. Why Do Fools Fall in Love?
Frankie Lyman.
Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. I was about 13. I started Parliament probably a year later, right around the same time. So Parliament's been around since about 56. But that was the record, Why Do Fools Fall in Love. And The Spaniels, of course. Most people would know nostalgically, Good Night, Sweetheart.
Mm-hmm.
Good night, sweetheart, well, it's time to go. A lot of people remember that one. But I remember some of their earlier doo-wop records. And they were the ones that actually made me want to, excuse me, you know, to really get into it. And plus, you know, in Newark, New Jersey, where I grew up at, everybody either sang or boxed or played ball. I tried boxing. That wasn't happening. I played ball. You know, I had a team, baseball team. They kicked me off my own team. So then I got my group together, and that's been working pretty good ever since.
Well, at the same time that you were singing with your group, The Parliaments, you were also running a hair salon, right?
Well, that was later on. I started the Parliaments, say, 56. By 59, I was working in a barbershop, you know, processing hair. You know, that go right along with the doo-wops. You know, you get your hair done, and you go stand on the corner and sing all day and night.
Mm-hmm. Let me get back to when you were in the barbershop, and you were conking people's hair. How were you wearing your hair at the time?
Conk, too. How did you know that phrase? You ain't supposed to know that phrase. That's the inside phrase. Conk is a real old one. That's what it was, though. I was wearing my hair the same way. Matter of fact, there's pictures around with, you know, hair slick, looking good, you know, waves. Make you seasick to look at my head. But it all worked real good for us because everybody in the band worked in the barbershop at that time.
Was style very important to you then?
Styles?
Mm-hmm. Was style very important, being stylish?
Style has always been important. That's why I think we are able to survive so much now. I can see styles coming long before they get here, and I can pretty much tell what goes with a style. So as I see it approaching, I try to jump into it early, and I can divorce myself from any previous styles as that being the only style in the world, which is what a lot of people have trouble doing, because the industry will tell you that ain't your bag, and you get trapped in a style or a setting. But having worked in a barbershop, styles was for, you know, fit faces or fit the time, if it was Easter or Christmas. You had all kind of styles that you could relate to. And like I said, faces. So you had a lot of variety of styles to appreciate. So I transferred that into music. And my whole life has been like one big style after another. And it all looked like, wow, he's been doing that all his life. You know, I forget that I have hair like I've got now. When I see somebody looking, I don't get upset because that's what I do for the attention. But I forget because it's so, so natural.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to play the first hit that you had back when your group was called The Parliaments.
Oh, my God. Ooh, luscious. You know, that was a big record in Detroit. That record broke right here in Detroit. I was back at the barbershop and giving up for a minute.
Well, here it is, George Clinton's first hit back from 1967, I Just Want to Testify. From 1967, that's George Clinton, The Parliaments.
Well, it sounds good to hear that again.
Yeah, it sounds really good. You were saying that when that record was a hit, you were working for Joe Bett, the publishing company of Motown Records. I once read you say that there was a lot you didn't like about Motown. You didn't like the idea of everybody in the group dressing alike and doing the same steps.
Not that we didn't like it. We loved it. But we just couldn't see ourselves overcoming the temptations or the pips. First of all, the temptation was from here, and the criteria for that, you know, at that time was height, you know, 6 feet. Matter of fact, they all were 6 feet. And we were like 5, 6, 2, 3. You know, we was all over the place. It wasn't uniform. And the routines and things, we had perfect. And the suits, of course, we had perfect. And the styles was perfect. But there was no way to outdo the Pips with the routine. They were the best routine and group that I've ever seen. And the Temptation had the perfect image, plus this was home for them. So it wasn't that we didn't like it. It was just no way for us to overcome the competition within the company. So we just threw the suit. And plus, it was hard to keep ties alike or shirts clean. Anyway, that was the hardest part of all. And so it was convenient when we realized that hippies and rock and roll and blues was the exact opposite of what we had been into all our life, because we could do this having fun. We'd wear the clothes bag as opposed to the suit. We'd take the suit out and throw it down and cut holes in the clothes bag and put it on. You know, and it became just a big joke at first. But the music was always, like, very soulful, churchy, you know, like Maggot Brain, psychedelic. You know, nobody had seen black groups doing psychedelic. They used to call us Temptations on Acid or James Brown on Acid, you know. But it always worked. And so we just, you know, changed our whole thing and went that way. So it wasn't that we didn't like the routines and things. It's just that it was convenient for us to go a different route.
Well, I want to talk with you more about your music, but first we're going to take a short break. George Clinton is my guest, and he has his first record out.
I have to get those out every now and
then. He has his first record out in 5 years, and we'll be hearing more from it in a few minutes. The album's called The Cinderella Theory. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is George Clinton. He founded the Parliaments in the 50s, later formed the psychedelic funk band Funkadelic. He's also just released his first new album in 5 years. It's called The Cinderella Theory. You were just saying that people used to call your group the Temptations on Acid. Were you doing a lot of acid yourself during that period? And what effect did psychedelics have on the kind of performances and stage shows you wanted to do?
Well, of course, you know, at that particular time, everybody did acid, mm-hmm. you know, and I did my share and two or three other people's share, probably. But at the time, I wasn't into equating it or analyzing it as it being the thing that helped us, even though later on, after I felt safe enough distance from that whole era, you know, and I love the era, but, you know, once you start to seeing that it was over, you start being afraid, then you say, oh, I made it through that. Then I realized that, okay, it did break me out of that mode of the streets of New York, New Jersey, the rat race that tend to make you feel like I got to do it to them before they do it to me. It definitely helped us all from that particular, because we was growing up into that, and that's what we would have been.
Since your music was inspired both by soul and funk, but also by acid rock, I was wondering if it was ever hard to kind of get accepted by both black and white audiences.
Both black, we could help with both black and white. You know, we was too black for most white audience, because there were so many of us. They could take Jimi Hendrix and, you know, the couple white guys, but here you had 10 guys up there acting all like they were from, you know, Newark, and we were. But it was all in fun. I think that one kept us alive for part time, and then the other one kept us alive, you know, as far as surviving. There was a core or cult following of, say, Maggot Brain fans or white fans from Boston, Toronto, parts of Michigan, you know, and Cleveland, in all the colleges, we had a good audience. And then towards the 71, it started being like a lot of black. We did America East is Young. A lot of the black audience started showing up. And by the time we did Cosmic Slop, it was really both, you know, but both wouldn't come to the other show. So we still had to do different places altogether.
Since you've done some barking for us already on the show, I thought I'd play Atomic Dog, which is one of the hits under the George Clinton name.
Yeah, y'all better get your doggy bags out now. Get your ticks out of there, okay?
Would you give us a sense of how this record came together?
Well, basically, we were off, you know, off the road for a couple of years, and it was the type of record that we had to put out because we're still going through litigation with the record companies and everything and reorganizing the thing. It was a record that I put out on my own first solo album. And I was trying new things because, you know, we didn't have nothing to worry about whether we got played or not. So I tried some different type things. And so Atomic Dog was just the kind of life I probably was living at the moment. I don't know intellectually really what made me do it, but I think we was getting felt dogged out by the record companies about our whole lifestyle or whatever was going on in the streets. Since we weren't working, you know, you tend to get back into all of the party things. And I think I was feeling dogged out, probably was dogging myself out at the time. But I just know I walked in the studio one day and just started singing. I didn't even know what I was singing about. And that's the way it came. And most of our songs come like that. We make sense out of it later. Somebody come along and say, did you mean so-and-so and so-and-so? And if it sounds real hip, I say, yeah, that's what I mean.
This is George Clinton's Atomic Dog.
Yeah, this is a story of famous dog. For the dog that chases its tail, house dog, street dog. Dogs of the world unite, dancing dogs. Yeah, kind dog. Funky dogs, nasty dogs.
Dog.
That's George Clinton's Atomic Dog. How did you start moving from singing to also producing and doing these really far-out rhythm tracks? I know you were always producing. You produced the Parliament's records, but it really became like a specialty of yours.
Well, after I realized that it was going to take more than one group to survive and, you know, and make it, any one group, it could be stopped any kind of ways or just be stopped because they're not good enough. But I think if you have a number of outlets for your stuff, when one style is saying that you're over with, another one will be saying that, oh, this is the new thing. So not only did Parliament Funkadelic, we did Bootsy, you know, as an offshoot to Brides, the Horny Horns, everybody that was in the band. So that gave me a lot of different outlets because so many members in the band can write and would have liked to have their own group, but they didn't want the hassles. So it was easy for me to utilize all the people in the band, and it kept my outlet wide open. Like right now, we got Funkadelic just released on MCA. My son is on, Tracy is on the Warner Brothers. I'm doing a guy called Babbling Kababy, and his record is like really funky. It'll be out pretty soon. And so I'm always continually cutting music and trying to keep another thing happening, because when they say it's over with this planned obsolescence trip, you know, if you ain't got but that one record, you got a problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, you not only have a lot of different bands that you've created and produced, you also have different alter egos that you've performed under, like Dr. Funkenstein.
Dr. Funkenstein, Mr. Wiggles, Sir Nose.
Would you describe one of your alter egos for our listeners who haven't seen you perform?
Okay, well, Sir Nose, you know, I will never dance. I shall never dance. Nobody can make me dance. I don't even make love. That voice, you know, harmonized on it, made it real high. But the voice was actually, I was imitating one of the guys that used to work in the barbershop, or used to come to the barbershop all the time. He had, you know, all the girls liked him. He was real cool, but he, as far as I was concerned, he was crazy. I mean, this dude stabs his car, you know, but he was a fun dude, and everybody liked him, and he was cool, but at the same time, he was a nut. And when I told him, like, you know, maybe 6-7 years ago that I had been imitating him with that voice, it tickled him because, you know, he's a grown man now and he remembered those things. But most of the voice, I usually use a character out of the barbershop, because, you know, the thing in the barbershop is to get up and tell lies. Well, I saw Sugar Ray fight Joe Louis in 27. Richard Pryor always do it. Those are the kind of things that always happen in barbershops. And I found that they work good on record. You know, like, make my funk the P-funk. I want my funk uncut. All of those are, you know, slang that's used, like, in the streets or in the barbershop. And you find more of it in the barbershop than you do anywhere. So a lot of the characters were based on people who I know their personality was penetrating when I did it. Dr. Funkenstein was like a FM disc jockey. W-E-F-U-N-K, We Funk, home of the extraterrestrial brothers, bringing you music to get your together by. You know, and all of those things were like just different places I know that was penetrating. And I knew that the DJ was missing off of radio. They had started doing the cartridge thing. So the personalities that you used to hear on the radio, like, let me see. Attention on radio station jocks. You got to be serious slamming on my box, because when I try my best to get into the decibels up so high that my neighbors call the cops. So when the thing get to tweaking, you know the groove is peaking. I mean harder than a cinder block. Okay, I know you know what I mean. I keep a party tweaking on my record machine. You know, and this, those kind of things, or those kind of jocks is like missing off of radio now. And, you know, and I figured, well, if I put this on Mothership Connection, it was the right thing at that time. And it's what most rappers tell me now that they got, or they learned rapping from, the Mothership Connection album.
You know, you're, I think, 48 now, nearing in on 50.
Just got to 48.
Okay. do you ever worry, though, about... if your image will have to change as you get a little older, like toned down from the kind of extravagance and sexual innuendo, you know, in the performances?
Oh, well, I changed. That changed a long time ago, sexual innuendos in you outdoors. And that, you know, it's redirected from, like, I wouldn't go to the front stage and flirt with the 13-year-old girls, but I would still probably say something really funky or dirty. You can always change that to fit whatever age, you know, and it's all the same. But I don't worry about that. As long as I don't be walking around here looking like this with no possible way of hit records, you know, if I don't have no possible way of hit records, then I told everybody around me, make sure I get rid of this Baby Jane look. You hip to Baby Jane, right? You know, so if I don't have no possible, and as long as I got some kind of reason to think that I got a record coming out, I don't mind looking different or weird or whatever, because to me it's only a style. But if it don't look like I'm ever going to put a record out, I tell everybody, remind me to cut this off my head.
You know, when we were setting up this interview with you, we found out that you don't have a telephone. And I couldn't imagine why.
I haven't had one for about 10 years. The Mothership can get in touch with you if it's need to be in touch with somebody. You don't really realize how much you don't need a lot of things until you... I mean, I know most people think I'm crazy then, for real, but the majority of things that you depend on, like, as lifeblood, is not really that.
I regret that we're out of time. It's really been wonderful to have you here. Thank you.
Good.
Thank you very much for doing the interview. Thanks for being here. My guest has been George Clinton. His new album, The Cinderella Theory, is on Warner Brothers Records. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Lawrence Grobel. He's just written a biography of the film family, the Houstons. John Huston directed The Maltese Falcon, Treasure of the Sierra Madre, and Pritzi's Honor, to name just a few. His father, Walter Huston, was an actor. John Huston's daughter is the actress Angelica Huston. I hope you can join us.
Let me tell you a little story about King Nut. The natives call him the Nubian Tut. Out of 14th century, he came to be somewhere around 2000 B.C. Where the natives clap for the Nubian savage, then sit back and listen to the King Nut's rap.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Violinist Shlomo Mintz was a child prodigy. He made his debut at age 11 with conductor Zubin Mehta. He's since gone on to perform with the world's great orchestras as one of music's great soloists. Coming up, we meet Shlomo Mintz. Also, rock historian Ed Ward profiles Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff, the pair that started Philadelphia International Records and packaged the Philly sound. And book critic John Leonard reviews Thunder at Twilight. It's Frederick Morton's second look at the events and people of pre-World War I Vienna. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The polls in Virginia closed just 30 minutes ago in a preliminary exit poll conducted by Mason Dixon. An Atlanta-based political research firm shows Douglas Wilder ahead in his bid to become the nation's first elected black governor. In another governor's race, two congressmen are facing each other. In New Jersey, it's Democrat James Florio versus Republican James Corder. In the only congressional seat on the ballot, 11 candidates are vying to fill out the term of the late Congressman Mickey Leland of Texas, killed in a plane crash last summer in Ethiopia. In New York City, in a closely contested mayor's race, Democrat David Dinkins is trying to become the city's first black mayor in his race with Rudolph Giuliani. In Cleveland's mayor's race, voters for the first time are choosing between two black candidates. Kevin Niedermeyer of members station WCPN has this report.
Here in Cleveland, despite nearly an all-day rain, voter turnout is running close to the predicted 70%. Election board officials say the latest turnout figure is around 40%. The turnout is running at 41% on the predominantly black east side and at 35% on the mostly white west side. This is expected to favor candidate George Forbes because the other candidate, Michael White, was expected to do better on the west side where turnout is lower. For National Public Radio, I'm Kevin Niedermeyer in Cleveland.
Tens of thousands of Namibians, many standing in mile-long lines that form before dawn, swamped polling stations across the territory to vote for independence from South Africa. Mike Wooldridge of the BBC reports on the first day of UN-supervised voting.
The first of the 5 days of voting seems to have gone well in general. Voter enthusiasm, combined with the thoroughness of the voting procedure, a deliberate guard against fraud, meant that long queues built up in many places. For the most part, people waited patiently. But there was one polling station in the north that, to the consternation of United Nations monitors, came under siege during the hottest part of the day when those waiting decided to make for the shade of the polling station entrance. Voters arrived to find many polling stations plastered with the posters and flags of SWAPO's main challenger, the DTA. The DTA says it's taking advantage of a loophole in the otherwise tight election rules, but the UN is trying to have the party symbols removed. In contrast, supporters of SWAPO have generally shown restraint and put away their party colors for the voting process.
Mike Wooldridge of the BBC. In Los Angeles, Richard Ramirez, convicted of murdering 13 people, has been sentenced to death in the gas chamber. The 29-year-old drifter from El Paso, Texas, was convicted in September of the so-called Night Stalker murders, along with 30 other felonies. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials closed up almost 15 points to close at 2,597.13 on volume of some 163,400,000 shares. Advances led declines 4-3 in active trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. You can't even think about pop music in the 70s without thinking of Kenneth Gamble and Leon Huff. They were the producers who created the Philly sound, the East Coast's answer to Motown. In the book Rock of Ages, Ken Tucker writes that Gamble and Huff gave their music a backbeat that was so strong, even white folks couldn't lose it. Rock and roll historian Ed Ward profiles this duo, but first, a little music to set the scene.
It was 1958, and in Philadelphia, the record business was going through the beginnings of a revolution. It was becoming more businesslike as Dick Clark and those around him helped develop stars in a very traditional Hollywood-like way. People were learning how to use recording technology, too, as on the smash hit At the Hop, which was supposedly by a group called Danny and the Juniors, but was actually a guy named Danny Terranova, multi-tracking himself. Playing piano on the session and co-producing was a young black man named Leon Huff. And in 1962, another talented young black man who sang with a group called the Romeos found his Juliet, Dee Dee Sharp, who was far more successful than the Romeos were with her hit, Mashed Potato Time. Gamble, however, was going to make sure he made pop music history and saw to it that the songs he wrote were shown to the right people around Philly. Finally, in 1964, he was working with a group called Candy and the Kisses on a song he'd written and found himself talking to the piano player on the session, Leon Huff. Gamble asked Huff if he'd like to join the Romeos, but the days of the doo-wops were pretty well over. Anyway, they found something else they could do better than sing.
Cowboys, the girls. I remember when I used to play shoot 'em up, bang, bang, baby.
Songwriters like Smokey Robinson had introduced a new lyrical sophistication into black pop, and in both Detroit and Philadelphia, the production values had gone way beyond where they'd ever been before. Gamble and Huff had enough experience to make records sound perfect, and enough street smarts to find the right talent. When they started having hits like Cowboys to Girls with local groups like the Intruders, people started paying attention, and before long, they were getting phone calls from the big boys, looking for production and songwriting help for people who hadn't had a hit in a while.
Girl, try to remember when we didn't have no shoes. We stuck together, just me and you. It took a long time to get what we got today. Now you want to give it all up for another guy. Baby, I'm telling you.
Of course, there was a plan at work here. Gamble and Huff were hoping to raise their stock high enough that they could get somebody to invest in a major production studio and record label so that they could start making the kind of records they wanted to make. It was the early 70s, a real good time for a minority-owned business to get off the ground. CBS Records came to the rescue. Gamble and Huff called a Cleveland group they'd been dying to work with, and the rest is platinum.
What they do? They smiling in your face.
Backstabbers was the first smash for the newly created Philadelphia International label, and it had all the trademarks that would make this the next great black pop label after Stax. Percolating percussion that never stopped, Wes Montgomery-style guitar playing octaves, dramatic string work, and a social message. With the OJs firmly ensconced on the roster, Gamble and Huff called on another group that had been scuffling in Philadelphia since 1956 and who had lost their lead singer in 1970, replacing him with their drummer, Theodore Pendergrass.
The love I loved was a sweet love. The love I loved was complete love. The love I loved, I will never, no, no, never love again.
I can remember planning. Remember hoping that you and I could make it all through.
On Harold Melvin and the Blue Note's first hit, The Love I Lost, you can hear another trademark of the Gamble and Huff sound, the zippy cymbal work that would elevate this label to the top of the heap in the next year or so as disco music leapt out of the clubs and onto the charts. I feel stupid even attempting to talk about Gamble and Huff and Philadelphia International in less than an hour. I don't have time to play some of the masterpieces they recorded by Archie Bell and the Drells, or the Three Degrees, or mention talented songwriters like Bunny Sigler, or their stable of incredible arrangers like Bobby Martin, Vince Montana, Norman Harris, Ron Have Mercy Kersey, and the legendary Tom Bell. But I figure you have to start somewhere, and I'll be profiling more Philly sound people in future shows.
Ed Ward is co-author of Rock of Ages, The Rolling Stone History of Rock and Roll, and he writes for the Austin Chronicle. This is Fresh Air. Shlomo Mintz is considered one of the finest violinists of his generation. New York Times music critic John Rockwell described Mintz as a sovereign technician and poetic interpreter. The 32-year-old soloist is also the music director of the Israel Chamber Orchestra. Shlomo Mintz was born in Moscow and emigrated with his family to Israel when he was 2. When he was 11, he made his concert debut with Zubin Mehta and the Israel Philharmonic. At the recommendation of Isaac Stern, he came to the States to study at Juilliard. Before we meet him, let's listen to a passage from the second movement of Prokofiev's Sonata for Violin and Piano, number 1 in F minor, with Yefim Bronfman at the piano. Ask you about playing the second movement of Prokofiev's first sonata for violin and piano. It's a very moody movement, and I wonder what you're thinking about when you're playing it, if you're thinking at all when you're playing it.
Well, the second movement basically should also be looked at not as a specific movement, but one should actually try to listen to the whole piece to see that it's. He has a very breaking mood, sort of a destructive, almost destructive mood from, that is a big change from the previous movement. Generally speaking, I mean, this music is very, very close to me. Prokofiev, he's a sort of a composer that has a lot of substance to it, melodical substance, as well as being very innovative for his own period. And besides those two points, very important points, he's also a very Russian composer. So, and I suppose I have a little bit of a Russian mix in me.
Mm-hmm.
So I seem to be very close to the music, yes.
Do you ever sing a passage of music to... did you get the feeling of it without having to worry about performing it, but just to feel the music before worrying about mastering the technique? And
sometimes I do, but my voice is so terrible. I mean, sometimes I do. I think that we, especially the string instruments, are the closest to the voice.
And in range.
In range. And yes, one would try to sing it because... You know, breathing, for example, is for us almost as identical as it is for singers. So it's very natural that even if I don't try to sing it, I try to hum it and say, "Well, wait a minute, let me see the way a singer would do it." It's almost a natural for us, and sometimes I don't even do it because I imagine automatically the way a singer would do it.
So you have to learn to breathe in between phrases.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, I was yesterday, done a Mozart concerto together with Ricardo Muti in Philadelphia. And I was very happy to see that Ricardo Muti, this was the first time I was with him on stage, and I was very happy to feel that he was really breathing the phrases while he was conducting. And I must say, there are very, very, very few conductors that actually take the time and deeply feel the phrase from a breathing point of view.
You were a prodigy. Did you feel managed and pressured any of the time when you were young?
Well, I went through a period where, yes, I was under a certain discipline, and one would spend a lot of time thinking, why am I doing this? And should I not be a lawyer or an accountant? Or but yes, I went through this period. But I know today that there is nothing else I'd rather do but be in music, because it covers so many things in life to people who really want to understand it.
Usually prodigies have parents who are very invested in their child's musical success. Did you ever feel that your parents wanted it too bad?
Well, perhaps they wanted it very, very much. But just to understand the mentality, I came from a rather unique family, because my father was 18 years in Siberia in a prison camp. He wanted to play violin all his life, and he couldn't because of that and because of economic difficulties. So he wanted his son to play the violin, and the best proof was that when I was 2 months old, he got me a violin. And so one should say that my parents were slightly anxious, but they were not over anxious, because on the other hand, my childhood was a happy childhood. There was a very healthy mix of very hard work and total letting steam out time with friends and relatives and everything, playing football, etc., and not really trying to spare my hands from this or that. It's important. It's an important point to remember, because today I'm not too fussy about lifting bags and carrying difficult tasks. It made me grow as a healthy person. I was not only your fragile violinist.
Well, I get the impression you've seen a lot of musicians who you feel didn't grow up in a healthy way.
In a way, yes.
Very neurotic.
In a way, and in a way, you're aware of the fact that art must have very healthy connections with life. It cannot be totally apart. We cannot swim in a God knows where world. And on the other hand, yes, we must have a very strong dimension to metaphysics, because we are the passageway for the audience who come and listen to us.
You've had a very international career, coming from Russian parents, growing up in Israel, then moving to the United States to study. Now you conduct the Israel Chamber Orchestra. You perform around the world. You live, at least most of the time, I think, in the United States. Do you think that...
We live in Europe, too.
Oh, okay.
And I have a family of two kids. My wife was born in Germany to an Estonian parent. My son was born in Lugano. The other son was born in Bonn.
Well, do you think that...
We have a house in New York.
Well, very, very international.
I can continue.
Do you feel that different nationalities bring different styles to music? I mean, when you're in a different country, or when you're playing with musicians from different countries, do you feel that there's a different accent, so to speak, to the music? And do you feel that growing up in different countries affected you? And, studying with teachers of different nationalities?
Well, The answer to your question is yes. I think that a person also carries his own set of experiences. And if you play, for example, say with a European musician, his education must have been slightly different approach to the instrument than, say, with American students or artists. But no, I don't really try to play in a different way, say, in Europe or in Japan than in the United States. Only because one has to be convinced. I think one has to follow a certain path individually in an unhurried way rather than try to divide the countries and try to please the audiences where they are.
Thanks so much for talking with
us. Thank you.
Violinist Shlomo Mintz performs with the Philadelphia Orchestra tonight in Philadelphia and tomorrow night in New York. He records for Deutsche Grammophon. This is the cadenza from the Brahms Concerto for Violin and Orchestra in D major, Opus 77. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with Robert Siegel. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We're going to be hearing from East Berlin, where today the government resigned. That is not, mind you, Egon Krenz, who's the head of state and the head of the party, but all the ministers are resigned en masse to form a new government. And we'll also be hearing from an opposition figure about what should come next for East Germany after this rather momentous event. We'll also be hearing about elections today in Namibia and a Bob Mondello review of the new film Apartment Zero, and also be hearing from a man who says he recycles culture, Malcolm McLaren.
Thanks, Robert. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Frederick Morton has returned again to his native Austria in his new book, Thunder at Twilight. It explores Vienna in the months before the outbreak of World War I. Morton's also the author of an investigation of earlier Viennese history, a family biography of the Rothschilds, and several novels. Book critic John Leonard has a review of Thunder at Twilight.
Frederick Morton, who was born in Vienna, won't leave it alone. His love and his hate show up in his novels, like The Forever Street, and in his edgy, impressionistic popular histories, like Thunder at Twilight. Thunder is a sequel to A Nervous Splendor, which looked with dismay at the capital of the Austro-Hungarian Empire during 10 months in 1888 and 1889, just prior to the suicide at Meierling of Crown Prince Rudolf after he'd murdered his teenage mistress, Mary. Rudolf, the only known Habsburg ever afflicted with liberal political tendencies, kept a human skull on his desk. Mary, an upwardly mobile tramp, died with a rose in her hands. Morton argued in A Nervous Splendor that Vienna either invented or lovingly nurtured that alienation about which modern man worries so much. If the emperor was conservative to the point of catatonia, the unofficial culture of Viennese artists, writers, and composers raged and seethed. There was blood in the pastry, and everybody danced, even the crazies at the annual ball at the insane asylum. The angst, Morton wrote, in Mahler's huge surges clutched at primal beginnings. Freud reached for a pre-Puritan libido. Herzl called for a return to the land of milk and honey. Klimt contorted his nudes into ancient Oriental opulence. Bruckner cried out for the freshness that lay forgotten in folk and faith. All these talents served an intuition maturing first in Vienna. Something important and green had turned golden and sick and petrified. Morton seemed almost to loathe this Vienna of cavaliers and epicures, of operettas, psychoanalysis, and anti-Semitism. Thunder at Twilight is the same story, except in 1913 and 1914. The Habsburg crown prince this time, who might have saved us from World War I, is the Archduke Franz Ferdinand. His assassination by Serbo Kroats started that war instead. Morton makes some heavy water out of Oedipal conflicts between Franz Ferdinand and his uncle, the emperor, between Jung and Freud, and between Trotsky and Lenin, who were all in Vienna at the time. Stalin also shows up briefly, and Tito too, when his name was still Braz, and Adolf Hitler, who was frightened by the May Day Workers' March, and the philosopher Wittgenstein, the atonalist Webern, the neurotic Kafka. Instead of alienation, Morton plays with Vienna as spectacle, what he calls the dramaturgy of pure gesture, parliaments as theater, restaurants as stage props, funerals as opera. Flourish, not fact, held the realm together, Morton says. Flourish painted the mirage of dynastic marriage between crown and people. They wore happy masks to a carnival of death. As in A Nervous Splendor, where he pushed too hard on the sinister vibrations from modernists who had really just barely gotten started, so in Thunder at Twilight, Morton overworks the filigree in the Baroque, the costumes and the cuckoo clocks. He loves too much the great man anecdote. His history is punchlines. He knows perfectly well that World War I owed more to a crisis in capitalism than to the lifestyles of dim-witted Habsburgs. But the Habsburgs make a better story, and it's never been better told, this foxtrot on the lip of the abyss.
John Leonard writes about television for New York Magazine, is a columnist for New York Newsday, and is media critic for CBS Sunday Morning. He reviewed Thunder at Twilight by Frederick Morton. Our reviews and commentaries are produced by Naomi Person, with assistance from Joan Tuohy and Roberta Sharrock. Joyce Lieberman is our technical director. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, actor Walter Huston, director John Huston, and actress Angelica Huston, as described by Lawrence Grobel, the biographer of the Huston family. Also, we meet Chris Difford and Glenn Tilbrook of the rock group Squeeze. I'm Terry Gross, and I hope you'll join me for the next Fresh Air.